Hey, Dan.
What up, guy?
You're into this fintech. What's all this I'm hearing about Current?
You're going to like this, guy. Current is a fintech company that's completely disrupting traditional banking.
Wait a second. Does that mean I don't have to drive to the bank anymore?
Yeah, exactly. I manage an important part of my family's finances from one easy-to-use app.
Well, I got to get this app, but where can I learn more?
It's super easy. Just go to current.com/OK, O-K-A-Y, and download the app. That's current.com/OK.
Current is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services provided by Choice Financial Group, member FDIC, and Cross River Bank, member FDIC.
Will M&A pick up in 2024? Will this year mark the return of IPOs? Listen to Strategic Alternatives, a podcast from RBC Capital Markets, to get fresh insights on the trends and market forces impacting deal flow across sectors and find out how companies and investors are preparing for potential surge in deal activity and what signals to watch for this year. Listen and subscribe to Strategic Alternatives, the RBC Capital Markets podcast today, wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to OK Computer. I am Dan Nathan, joined by Deirdre Brosa. She is the host of CNBC's Tech Check. Debo, welcome back.
Thank you. Hello again from San Francisco.
Yeah, we got a big show. We got a follow-up on last week's show that got a lot of interest. That was our funders and founder series, Ann Bordetsky of NEA, who led Perplexity's A round with Arvind Srinivas, and some news there this week, days after just us speaking to them about the company, about their positioning in the space, about valuations, and a whole heck of other things. We're going to talk about that a little bit. And our funders and founder series continues this week with my friend Matt Turk, who is a partner at Firstmark. Matt, as many of you know, he's been on the pod before. He has been in machine learning and AI for a long time. He publishes the MAD Report. And we also have Florian Duetto. He is the co-founder and CEO of Data IQ. That is a Firstmark company, and they have been invested in that for years. So we're going to talk about how they are playing in the Gen AI space. And they are not somebody who's just come to this over the last year. They've been in this business with a mindset for it for years. So stick around for that conversation. All right, Debo, you and I, we got a lot to cover here because, again, this is an app that at one time was near and dear to your heart, less so here. It seems to be a bipartisan issue to shut it down in America, but then the former president on CNBC's air yesterday did a bit of a flip-flop on the TikTok and on the banning of it. Now, it's funny because I think, and I'd love to get your take on this, the company came under some fire, so it's owned by, obviously, ByteDance out of China, and so this is going back to the Trump administration. I think at the time, then President Trump was talking about outright banning it, and then it moved to more of a divestiture, and then it just lost some steam. But over the last couple of years, it's become very bipartisan. And really, the company, I guess they did a push notification to their users, basically scaring the crap out of all the teenagers out there, saying the government's going to take away your favorite app, so push back. But really, this bill is not about a ban of the app. It's about a divestiture from being wholly owned from a Chinese entity. Let's talk about this. And I know you're talking to a lot of folks out there in the Valley. What's the take on this out there?
The take, I think, generally is that this is going to be very difficult to pull off a ban or a divestiture. Even when we were talking about this back in 2020, remember the rumors that Oracle and Walmart wanted to get together for financing to buy the thing? The Chinese government will not allow TikTok to be separated from ByteDance. Why would they? So this is lawmakers being lawmakers. It's political theater. China is a bipartisan issue. Being hawkish on China is a bipartisan issue. The more interesting thing is Trump's flip-flop. What does that say about TikTok? And what does it say about Meta, the Facebook parent?
And I guess that focus, I'm curious of your take on that. So he said to Squawk Box yesterday morning, which would have been Monday, where we're recording this Tuesday afternoon, that the CCP doesn't have any control over Trump. This is when the host pushed back at him a little bit for the misinformation and a whole host of the security risks that I think a lot of lawmakers think is fairly legitimate. Obviously, the Biden administration just launched, or at least maybe his campaign, TikTok, and they're talking to the people there. So it just seems like a lot of folks, at least in Washington, can't figure out which side of this argument to be on.
And I guess the takeaway is there is no great social media side, right? You're picking a house in a bad neighborhood out there. But for Trump specifically, his campaign doesn't post on TikTok, but it has a huge audience on TikTok. His speeches, his content gets sliced up and put all over this platform and reaches that demographic that everyone wants, right? It's 150 million users in America. Many of those are that younger demographic that's so appealing to politicians. And you juxtapose that with the President Trump content on Facebook and Instagram, it's a little less straightforward, right? They've pulled back. It has a history with, you touched on, election misinformation, amplification. So if he has to choose the best of the worst, he's not going to say, let's ban TikTok right before an election. And by the way, even President Biden on it, actually posting from a TikTok account.
All right. So what did you make, though? Because I thought this was interesting yesterday that obviously Facebook and his comments about Facebook as being the enemy of the people, and he's got a pretty good name over there for Zuckerberg, CEO of Meta there. What do you make of that? The stock was down 4% yesterday. He basically said a ban of TikTok would make Facebook that much stronger. And so that is interesting in a lot of ways, because I think a lot of folks look at, he leveraged Meta in the 2016 campaign in a big way, and it helped him get elected. In 2020, I think that it seemed to be a bit more of a level playing field. But the fact that he's really focused on this on Facebook and not a Chinese-owned app, where there seems to be a lot of debate about really what their intent here is in the U.S., that sets the stage for a very interesting regulatory environment if we are subjected to a second term of Trump.
And I think that the idea that he's already used Meta, so Facebook and Instagram, are wise to how he uses that platform. And if you think that TikTok is a bit more freer or is controlled by the Chinese and they prefer more chaos, they prefer more to go on at this social media level, then it makes sense, everything that he's doing.
I want to go back to TikTok for 1 second here, Dee. And I know that you are a fan of Ben Thompson and Stratechery, and he had a great note out a couple days ago. And I thought this was interesting, his view here. And he's been talking about this, I guess, since the initially proposed ban years and years ago. He said, this is also the rather obvious point that U.S. social networks are banned in China. Sure, it's unfortunate for ByteDance that they have spent so much time and effort building up his TikTok network in the U.S., but the possibility of a ban has always been a sword of Damocles hanging over the company. To that end, a divestiture again for what would certainly be a not insignificant price seems like a good outcome, all things being considered, a certainly pragmatic one. I thought that was an interesting way. Listen, for the company to divest it, they look around and they see companies like Meta that are nearing $1 trillion in market cap. And so the idea of being forced to sell that right now might not be a great thing, but that's just the U.S. or Western sort of apparatus.
It's an interesting idea. And there are already many American investors that are in Bytes, right, that have brought it to that $268 billion valuation is the last. You've got a Sequoia. You've got, I believe you have some of the big crossover funds in TikTok as well. The question, would it be as valuable separated from ByteDance? And I think that's an interesting question for the investors that are already in it. And you have a Sequoia that has its China arm now. Ben Thompson, he sits in Taiwan, so he knows the China dynamic better than anyone. But I am a little skeptical that China would let this go, almost like the face of it, right? Letting go one of their most successful companies that has had success overseas. And then they do that. But then what are you going to do about Temu and Shein, the other Chinese companies that are in the e-commerce space that have made huge inroads into the US as well? Temu is owned by JD.com, a Chinese company. Would they eventually sell that off? It's an interesting proposition.
No doubt. And we've been talking about it a little bit on Fast Money over the last week or so. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal talking about Temu and Shein, talking that they were the biggest advertisers on Facebook last year. And we know that obviously a good part of their advertisers are small and medium-sized businesses. A lot of folks think that they're these huge multinational businesses advertising on there. So when you see a new entrant to the market here in the U.S. adding billions of dollars in revenue, that's like a meaningful thing. So at some point, this sort of tit for tat with China is going to catch up to all players, despite the fact that most of our digital companies are banned in China. And that's kind of Ben's point. So I thought that was interesting.
And by the way, it's too late. 150 million Americans that are using TikTok. It's already grown. And when I lived in China, it wasn't like the Chinese, especially the youth, weren't accessing some of our apps through VPNs. And I think that's the most likely outcome, is that even if it was banned here, the youth would find a way to access it. However, to President Trump's point, it could give Meta a boost, right? Because they've developed Reels and they're, as the copycat, really gaining a lot of traction there.
Yeah, no doubt. But it's interesting for an American first sort of guy leaning into TikTok and against Meta. It's an interesting juxtaposition there. Let's talk about Perplexity for a second here, because this is one that I know you had the CEO on Tech Check, I want to say a couple months ago. He's hitting the podcast circuit. He was on with us. I guess we figured out why. There's an article in the Journal the day after our pod dropped. It says Perplexity set to double valuation to $1 billion. IVP led their Series B, I think it was in late January, early February, which was a little over a half $1 billion. Now they're talking about Daniel Gross, a former partner at the venture firm Y Combinator, leading this second round. I think from what I hear, there's some strategics that are circling the wagons here a little bit too. So this one is a bit of a moonshot as far as evaluation is concerned. It seems like lots of folks are very focused on this company. And again, you and I talked about it last week. This is not a company that has developed a large language model and put out a chatbot. It is a chatbot wrapper that is becoming behavior for a lot of folks, those who are paying. I think the article also mentioned that they just passed $10 million in annual revenue. That is obviously their subscription portion, but there's going to be a very large and growing free product here. And this is going to be an answer engine, not a search engine, Debo.
I wonder, Dan, if you saw those comments from the chief business officer at Alphabet last week here in San Francisco at the Morgan Stanley TMT conference. I thought he was quite good on Google's proposition here, right? We spent a lot of time talking about how Google is losing out to the likes of ChatGPT and Perplexity. Even though it's just a wrapper, it's a better wrapper. It's a better user interface than what Google is offering because it's stuck. But Philip Schindler, that is the chief business officer at Alphabet, in his discussion at that TMT conference, he said they're still gaining market share in every major market. And what they're finding is they're putting advertisements above and below their experimental generative AI results. So in a weird way, it makes you take a step back, say, okay, we know that Google has botched the rollout of Gemini. We know that this is really like the first existential threat to Google search, one of the best businesses in the world in many years. But Google's doing what Google does, right? It is using its distribution to maybe find new ways for advertising and inserting advertising into generative search. And Perplexity, even though it's very buzzy and people are using it here, like $10 million in revenue, it's nothing. And you have to imagine that if Google suddenly does figure it out, where does that leave a Perplexity? And what Philip Schindler's comment said to me last week is that Google is figuring it out. We can't count them out.
The public markets have spoken a little bit about their execution and the products that they brought to market. And that's just obviously been over the last few months. And the underperformance in Alphabet has been notable. You and I have talked about it a bit. But for a company, an upstart like this that's attracting a lot of attention on the valuation front, given that very low revenue base, I think it's important to note that just talking to Arvind, they're not even focused on advertising. If they can get to a certain scale, that free model is where lots of folks who've been searching the internet for 25 years, they understand the value proposition of getting that low latency response of that thing that you're looking for. There's got to be a way to pay for that. And right now, I think that Arvind has the VC community subsidizing that right now. They're very focused on what Google does very well, but they actually have taken it that next step about contextualizing your question and giving you a proper sourced answer. And that is what changes the game. And if people really become addicted to that sort of behavior, that sort of search answer behavior, they will be fine seeing ads. And you and I know this. Think about our kids, more and more about AI applications. You're going to hear about how do people born into this new world, this new digital world, how do they live? And think about our kids who are born into a digital world. They don't care about ads. They don't care about watching long form content with ads on YouTube and the like. And we are the ones who've been spending first $10.99 and now $14.99 for digital subscriptions without ads because we're sick of them. That's what we grew up into as far as the TV world. So it'll be interesting to see how this behavior manifests itself over the next few years or so.
Yeah, I like that idea of that the VCs are funding Perplexity to get that massive scale and they can figure out this business model later. But remember, there were so many businesses built on that premise, right, over the last 10 years that really struggled to monetize when they got to that point. We're still so early, is the point. And you do raise a good question. How are our kids going to be searching the web in the future? Is it going to be through Perplexity, ChatGPT? And is Google going to come out with something? That is really the question. Right now, you can toggle between Google and Gemini, but very subtly, Google is adding generative AI. I think you have to opt in at some point. And if you are using Google right now, you are actually experimenting with generative AI. So they're just subtly getting you used to that. So Google is playing on those habits as well. And I do wonder if at a certain point, because they have those billions of users versus Perplexity, which is starting from the ground up, if Google ultimately wins that race. I don't know, but Philip Schindler's comments, last week made me do a double take and say, maybe they're figuring this out in ways.
It is interesting that Google stock, which had sold off, I think, 5 or 6% in the last week and a half or so, has regained a lot of that ground. So it's interesting. I think those comments definitely did help from the Morgan conference. I'll just say this, if you want to do a deeper dive with Arvind Srinivas and his views on everything that you just talked about, competing with the likes of Google and business models and getting to scale and staying really focused on something, he had a great podcast that came out last week, and it wasn't the OK Computer podcast. It was great, but it was a different focus. But it was with Patrick O'Shaughnessy of Invest Like the Best. And it was a really great deep dive on actually the product they're building and who they see as their competition, the sort of focus that they have. I really enjoyed it. I listened to that over the weekend. We'll put that in the show notes. One last thing, Dee, before we get out of here. Friday afternoon, huge reversal in a lot of the names that a lot of folks have pegged to this kind of generative AI trade. NVIDIA, from an all-time high, reversed intraday and had a peak to trough sell-off, about 10%. Just think of that. It was about a $230 billion market cap move from its highs to its lows. Here we are. It's Tuesday midday. And you know what? NVIDIA has recaptured a bunch of that ground. The stock is up 4%. Taiwan Semi, which has been an absolute monster of late, also up about 4% today. It seems there's going to be emotional moves in this trade, but man, they just can't quit it because they keep coming for it on the dips a little bit. Curious as far as the public markets are concerned on valuations. And listen, next week is NVIDIA's GeForce. I'm sure that's all we're going to be talking about for the next few days. But is there a trade in front of that? Are people going to be getting long because we know how good Jensen is in front of an audience?
We keep looking for these moments to sell on the news, and it never really happens with NVIDIA. I'm so glad you asked about valuation, because what I've been covering today on CNBC is the expiration of the ARM lockup, right? And ARM has become this AI chip darling because its CPUs are needed to complement NVIDIA's GPUs. So it's got some of that halo effect, but that halo effect has become ridiculous. When you look at the valuations, which we always love to go back to, consider this. The forward price to earnings ratio of ARM is more than triple that of NVIDIA's. That is just a wild premium. And if you look at those kinds of numbers, and you even look at NVIDIA's valuation compared to others in the chip space, it still isn't crazy, even though the whole space is going up. I realize that. I wonder, Dan, if you have been tracking this ETF, ticker NVDL. I checked it out today. This is an ETF that gives investors 2 times the daily return of NVIDIA. It has gone absolutely parabolic. It has grown to $1.4 billion since launching at the end of 2022, nearly tripled this year. It's up, I believe, another, last I looked, 12% today. And this is like the NVIDIA case on steroids, right? Because you can imagine if the stock goes the other way, holders in this ETF are going to lose.
Well, the other thing is, to get that exposure, the instruments that they use to try to do that, there's also a tremendous amount of decay. So at some point, if it comes in really hard, let's say going against reason for its existence, and then if it were to just settle out, you could lose a lot of money on a daily basis, the premium, that the leverage that was used to get that. So these things are pretty dangerous. And I think the history of these inverse ETFs, of these leverage ETFs, there's also another one I was recently asked about in a video where there's a long stock selling call premium against it. So taking in a little bit of premium there. When you start getting that creative about a thing, in my opinion, from my history, it's usually about over. It's like the kind of mania we've seen this in crypto and the like over the last few years. So I appreciate you bringing that one up. I have not seen that one. So we'll
And absolutely. I only bring it up as an indication of how bullish people have become on NVIDIA, that they're willing to take that kind of risk to double their return on a stock that has itself just gone.
And listen, I'll just make one last point in this, is that I've been a pundit on CNBC and podcasting for a while. And 10 years ago, if you said anything negative publicly about Apple, you would get absolutely slayed. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, it started. They didn't care about Apple as much anymore. And then it was Tesla. And now the Tesla bulls are fighting with each other all over Twitter. So you don't have to worry about that. You can say whatever the hell you want about Tesla. And now it's NVIDIA. And so my point is, once you get to that point where the true believers can't consider a single negative comment out in the public space, you're probably ready for a little bit of a pullback there. All right, Debo, I really appreciate you coming on, making the time for us on OK Computer. I hope I'll see you next week.
Always happy to. See you next week.
All right, thanks so much. All right, stick around for my conversation on the Funders and Founders series, brought to you by RBC Capital, with Matt Turk of First Mark and Florian Dueto, the co-founder and CEO of DataIQ.
Hey, listeners, it's Dan here. I want to tell you about a company that I'm really excited about. It's called Current. It's a fintech company that's completely disrupting traditional banking. I'm a new Current customer. It's already helping me and my entire family manage our finances, all from one easy-to-use app. So try Current for yourself and get the app by going to current.com/OK. That's current.com/OK.
Current is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services provided by Choice Financial Group, member FDIC, and Cross River Bank, member FDIC. In today's hyper-fast markets, it's never been more important to consider every option to raise capital, drive growth, and create value. Stay one step ahead with Strategic Alternatives, a podcast from RBC Capital Markets. In this season, RBC's experts will examine how corporates and investors are evaluating their strategic plans, reassessing their portfolios, and reallocating capital to help them lead today and define tomorrow. Tune in to Strategic Alternatives, the RBC Capital Markets podcast today.
Welcome back to OK Computer. I'm Dan Nathan. I am joined by Florian Duetto. He is the co-founder and CEO of Data IQ, and Matt Turk, who is a partner at Firstmark Capital. Very good friend. Welcome back to the pod, Matt.
Thanks for having me back.
Florian, how about this? In town from Paris, and you decide to come over to OK Computer for our Funders and Founders series. This is, I think, at the fifth episode in the series, and we've had a lot of great conversations with some amazing founders and folks who've led some of their early rounds, and we've really focused on the background of the founders and the reason and the mission for the business, but what also attracted the investor to the organization and how that relationship's involved and the like. And yours, when Matt and I were talking about who would be great to come on this series, he said, Florian, for a whole host of reasons. I know you led their Series A back in
2016,
and you've been on the board, and you guys have done a number of financings since then and partnered with a lot of great investors. And obviously, Matt, you guys have participated along the way here. I'd love to start, Florian, a little bit about your background and how you founded this firm. And then I'd love Matt to talk about a little what attracted you to Florian as an entrepreneur and obviously the company and the mission.
Yeah, thanks for having me. As a background, I started the company in 2013. And so back then, I was already passionate by data. And at that time, the world was evolving quickly with companies very interested into how they could actually leverage data more. Back then, we were talking about big data. And as companies were building those assets, they were also discovering how to use AI, traditional AI, more effectively, the so-called machine learning capabilities and data science back then. And my passion was like, how can you make it available to as many people as possible? And my gut sense was that you don't have enough data scientists in the world to do everything that data science can do. And so can you build a platform, a tool powerful enough for more people to actually do that, leverage that and make it easier to use? And that's how I started DataIQ back then.
Yeah. And so how has the mission evolved over the last 10 years? Because it's interesting, you guys are not one of these, this American term, Johnny come latelys to the space. We've all been around. We remember the late 90s and how just this transformative technology of the internet and the promise, how it was changing first tech companies and how they thought about the business that they were in, but then almost every other sort of industry. And a lot of folks did a lot of goofy things, but you guys have been here from the beginning. Obviously, machine learning and data science is your background, but evolving towards AI. I went back and looked at some of your writings from 7-8 years ago. You were talking about things that seem very common now in the tech landscape, but they weren't that common back then.
Yeah, indeed. But I think that when sometimes as an entrepreneur, you're lucky and sometimes you're not lucky. When you're not lucky, you have to pivot and so forth. And then you become lucky. Maybe you get your luck through pivot. In our case, I think that we stayed on the same mission, which is like, would you democratize those technologies? And it's just that those technologies evolved a lot in the last 10 years. Back 10 years ago, it was really about how you stitch data together, or you build like simple models, or can you make sure that companies derive value out of data in a very easy fashion? And now you do almost sci-fi things. And indeed, we add, and as an engineer, from my background being in engineering, I like that. I like to build platforms that have to evolve through time. And we had to make our own product to evolve in order to match this constant evolution of technologies. And indeed, as of late, we integrated with generative AI and the large language models in order to provide this power back to our customers.
Yeah, so like enterprise AI, give us the 411, because a lot of us have been really focused on some of these consumer-facing sort of products, and I think that's captivated a lot of the headlines of late. When you think about, like, in my world as a public markets investor and a pundit, we spent a lot of time talking about some of the biggest companies globally by market cap and what they're doing in generative AI, and some of them have gained trillions of dollars in market cap just on some of these things. There are large enterprise components of that. So talk to us about what enterprise AI means to you and your company, Dedaiku.
Enterprise AI is this ability to use AI to make your business more efficient. That's about it. And then it trickles down to every aspect of your business. That's where it becomes complicated, because it's literally every aspect of the business. We see use cases in HR, in finance, in operation, in research, in how you sell, in how you promote, in how you support your customers and so forth. Because everywhere there is a human, everywhere there is a process, you can actually leverage AI and the data and the history and now generative AI in order to automate and make better decisions.
How has this changed, though? Because you gave a great example in 2013. You were really focused on big data. And I remember, again, this is going back to me sitting on CNBC's Fast Money desk, and we get to see narratives. We get to see how the C-level suite adjusts to what is working in the market. And I remember one day, and I want to say it was probably 14 or 15, where eBay finally talked about using big data, like all this unstructured data and how it's going to drive efficiencies and yada, yada, yada. And I remember the stock gapping up huge. That's in my world a little bit, but you were in the big data space 10 years ago. What's the through line, right, over the last decade or so to where we are as far as enterprise AI? Because a lot of it has obviously, like to your point, has been building on this one after another over the last decade or so.
I think the world of technology is a world where you've got initially lots of expectations that can drive the market. And then you've got execution that is initially slower than expected, but ultimately has potentially bigger impact than initially expected. Indeed, back 10 years ago, it was lots of expectation related to big data, but companies were struggling in terms of how to get things done. But over time, most companies actually built capabilities in terms of so-called traditional AI, using AI to help you with your pricing strategy, to help predict demand, make sure that you purchase the right number of goods, don't have unnecessary inventories, make sure that you can personalize the way you address to your customers, make sure you can leverage internal and external data to manage better your assets. Those models are running continuously, and large organizations have typically these days hundreds of models in production. So they use AI models, their own tiny models based on their data, on a daily basis. And that's just a fact, and they build those assets over time in the last 10 years. And now it's a new wave with new expectations, where maybe with generative AI, we can actually further bring that along to a next level of automation. That's how I see that.
Matt, you've been writing the MAD, the machine learning, artificial intelligence, and data landscape. I think we should call it, I got a bone to pick. Shouldn't it be like MAID? Like now, MAID a little bit, or no? Would that kind of screw up everything? I know you've worked very hard on this every year for the last, 10 years, 11 years? It is an amazing report. I think it's one of the last times that you and I spoke when you launched your 2023. And at the time, I remember thinking ChatGPT 3.5 had just come on the scene, and we just started to see a lot of excitement, at least in the public markets. Obviously, you have been investing in the space in the private markets for a while, but let's talk a little bit about just the evolution of your thought process in and around these technologies, and what attracted you to Florian and Dedaiku in the first place?
It's interesting because my history with Dedaiku comes directly from that work in many ways. That's a little bit of a cliche in venture capital, which is that any good investment comes from knowing a secret or two, meaning that you know something about the world that not many people know just yet. And in the case of Dedaiku, there were effectively two secrets. One was that data science, machine learning, and AI in the enterprise was going to be a big deal. And to the point about big data that we were discussing a minute ago, for me, that was the very clear next step. All right, so you have all these massive amounts of data. You have all these technologies, you know, back in the day at that time to store it. The next bit was, okay, what are you going to do with it? And data science and machine learning was really the way to extract knowledge and action from all of that. So that was one bit. It was going to be a big deal. Back when they were doing their Series A, or even after, I had some VC friend that would come to me and say, data science is just like a tiny market. There's two data scientists per company. Like, how is that company going to make any money? But that was a secret. That's going to be a big deal. And the second secret, where I had an unfair advantage by way of my background, was to know that France is an amazing country for this type of thing. France has a long tradition around AI that goes back to math education and all the things. Yann LeCun, one of the three godfathers of modern AI, is French, and so on and so forth. And I knew that French engineers in particular were particularly strong in that domain. It's one of the very rare moments in my venture capital career, perhaps the only one, where at the same time I had two companies coming to us for a Series A investment. There was Didaiku and there was another American company. It was a very smart people. But I knew that to build a data science and enterprise AI platform, you needed to build a lot of product and you needed to have a lot of engineers doing very productive work. And I love the idea of working with a French company where, like, for the same $10 million, you could have like 2 or 3x more engineers doing fantastic work and that AI background. And that's why I chose to partner, and of course Didaiku then chose to partner with me, which is a separate thing. That's why I decided to make that investment based on those two secrets.
All right, so Florian, that's really interesting. So my French friend in New York City as a VC invested in a French company, led a Series A, and I'm assuming that maybe some of your seed investors were more local. What attracted you to a New York venture firm back then to lead your Series A and partner with you at that point?
Twofold. One aspect is like just getting to the US as quick as possible when you start from Europe is paramount, just because that's where you're making the enterprise software market. That's just a fact. You need to. And we had, right before our Series A, had proven our ability to actually engage with Fortune 5000 customers and American ones. I was like, we just need to double down. We just need to be able to have the means to execute and to be recognized locally and build our workforce, our sales force locally in the US. So that was motivation number one, and especially New York as a place where you could actually build the operation of the company, as being in between the West Coast and Europe, like the ideal location when you're starting from Europe. And second aspect was more intuitive personae, meaning at the end of the day, Series A investor, if you're successful, is someone you meet for quite some time, as in multiple years. And I'm sometimes saying that when you work in a startup, if you're not successful, it doesn't really matter. But if you're successful, you're in for 15, 20 years, which is more than most relationships. And so you actually need to select people intuitive personae. And Matt had an uncanny perspective of our market, again, back to his work with the MAD landscape. I think it was the perfect fit for us.
So he and I have talked about the MAD landscape, and it's something here, it's taken like a life of its own in New York, Matt, over the last, how long have you been doing like the in-person events? Because I've yet to been invited to one. I don't know why, but I see
I know people who can get you.
Okay, fine. But I see lots of video and I see all the engagement on social. They're big in-person events and they get lots of play and they have lots of like great founders and investors talking about stuff. In my opinion, before it's like on the tips of, let's say, some of the like the chamoles like me on CNBC's tongue. So I find it a great resource. And oftentimes when I'm researching a topic for a podcast, you will have already had the CEO founder of a company that I'm looking at on there. Talk to me a little bit about that ecosystem. For instance, for someone like Florian and his team over in Paris who are trying to get greater connectivity here, greater brand awareness with the sort of companies that ultimately you hope to sign up as customers. What has that meant for you as a venture investor? But you're also really into the content. You're very passionate about it. That's almost its own vertical for you.
I do three things maybe for clarity for like anybody listening to this. So I do the MAD landscape, and MAD stands for machine learning, AI, and data, which is a giant market map that comes every year. The 2024 edition actually should come out in the next couple of
I'm
weeks.
I'm waiting for it.
Yeah,
for it.
I'm saying
it's
this.
Been changing a lot, I'm assuming, over the last
Yeah, it's been
months.
Changing yeah. quite a bit, yeah. and that, like every year it becomes harder to do. But anyway, so I do the landscape, and then I do an in-person event called Data-Driven NYC, which is a big meetup with 20,000 members, which has become the largest data and AI meetup in the country. And then the third thing I do is now I have a podcast. I'm a VC, so I have to have a podcast, right? That's the MAD podcast. So
what do you guys, you talk about like the Ukraine war, Gaza?
Yes,
like
exactly.
All
yeah,
sort of
completely,
stuff. Okay.
Yeah, because I'm a VC, therefore
okay.
all my opinions,
I'm just checking.
All my opinions on the world matter.
Yes.
No, so that we talk about the same exact topics as the above. But doing the three things is fun to do and has the power of creating communities and creating relationships and opportunity to speak with a lot of people and all the things. But ultimately, for me, it's not about creating the content. So it's almost not the output that matters. It's the input. It's the forcing function as a venture capitalist to every week, every month, every year, having to do the work. And the fact that it forces me to do the reps. So it's like going to the gym almost, if you think about it. So that's the...
Do you think VCs have gotten kind of lazy? Because it seems like it's one of those...
I think it's like all jobs, right? Like you have 80% of people that are doing an okay job. Out of the 80%, there's probably a bunch that do a pretty bad job. And then you have 20% that do a fantastic job. And my partner, Rick, that's at First Mark, like humbly, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to be in that elite group. And it's super hard to get to that group.
How has it been? Because I was with Rick this summer and he's on the board of a company in London. He's on the board of a company in Austria. You're obviously on the board of a country in France. Obviously being here in New York, you sit in kind of the middle of Europe and the West Coast and the like here. How has that kind of played into some of the strategies? Because like to your point about Florian, we just seen some big deals with some large U.S. enterprise companies, with a French company that's building a large language model. It seems like there is no geographic bound to what is being built now these days and the opportunity for venture investors like you to invest in. It seemed like in the last cycles, it seemed to be a bit more, whether it be West Coast centric, a lot of the fintech stuff here in New York. It just seems like it's really opened up a lot over the last 5 years or so.
One of the big stories of the last 10 years has been the globalization of entrepreneurship. And Europe has been a big part of that story. And not that long ago, you would meet a European entrepreneur and they would want to be the best company in France or the best company in Germany or the UK. And then really in the last 5, 6, 7 years, people basically became more confident. Now, anybody that you meet in those countries wants to build the biggest, largest global category leader. Nobody's interested in being a local champion. And that's because they've seen companies do it. If you think of the UiPath and Celonis and Sonen Dedaiku in enterprise AI, people have done it again and again. And that's completely shifted mentalities over there. And so we, First Mark, love that trend and love those companies that start in Europe, have global ambitions from day one, and then end up having a foot in Europe and a foot in the US. And typically you would have product and technology in Europe, and then you would have most of the go-to-market in the US. That works super well time and again.
All right, so this might be cheesy. Last week on Funders and Founders, we had the CEO and co-founder of Perplexity on. Okay, so Arvind Srinivas, I know you've talked to him at Data Driven. So my producer, Jacob, who does a great job helping me research the topics and the people that come on the pod, he thought it would be fun to figure out what Perplexity would think it would be good to ask Florian about your company. So I'm going to try a couple of these questions and you tell me what you think about this, okay? So on enterprise AI and business optimization, explore the concept of enterprise AI focusing on optimizing business processes rather than futuristic applications like flying cars. What do you think of that, Florian? Is that a decent question? We went to the answer engine at Perplexity.
Yeah, I think it's a decent question. I think it almost calls for an essay for me to write. Yeah. But indeed, and I wonder whether actually this sentence of flying car is actually something I actually said in the past.
Oh, really?
So yeah. I kind of like recognize myself, which is funny.
Yeah.
But indeed, a lot about enterprise AI is indeed about like very mundane use cases, which starts with how can you recommend the proper product, send the proper content to your audience, how much handbags will be sold in China next year, next quarter, next week based on history. That's where it starts. And indeed, that's where you get today the efficiencies coming from in terms of business operation from enterprise AI. It does require discipline. It does require the right data infrastructure, but it does also requires people, meaning people from the domain, people from the business being involved and working on the data in order to actually reap those benefits. And I think that's a revolution that we have seen in the last 10 years is like all of the people coming from the business getting their hands into data instead of asking for someone dummy reports, getting way more sophisticated, getting way more data driven, and it changed the destiny of businesses that were able to do so.
So it's interesting. So Jacob just put in my chat right here. So in a conversation with you in 2021, you did make some reference to flying cars. So is this going to start freaking you out a little bit? Because in my business, people look at me and they often think I'm like a journalist because I'm on CNBC. I'm not a journalist. So oftentimes people will say off the record, so you've written a lot, you're on social, you speak at events that maybe you think are being recorded or not, you don't know. All of this stuff is going to be coming back and it's going to become a narrative you know what I mean? With these platforms, I guess, like a wrapper like Perplexity has the ability to draw on a lot of different models that are doing a whole host of different things. How do you think about that, Matt? Because it's kind of interesting. I have a couple other really good questions, I think, here from Perplexity, and I'm worried about losing my podcasting job. But in the meantime, the fact that we could literally just put a few really good questions into this and it could pump out a whole narrative, which gives us good questions to have these sorts of conversations. Like, things are just accelerating in a way. There were engines that did this sort of stuff, but they weren't unleashed. There was something about ChatGPT 3.5 that really did something infinitely better than whatever the prior thing is.
I'm wildly enthusiastic about all those new tools coming up. I think we all are in the early innings of figuring out how to use them. It's interesting that you mentioned Perplexity. I use Perplexity as well. So I did data-driven, March edition of data-driven last night, and it did the same exact thing. Interestingly enough, in my questions for Florian, that one of them was widely hallucinated. Perplexity suggested I asked Florian about Didaiku's synthetic data vault product. Mm. And like, I'm on the board. I was like, oh, should I?
All right, we'll cut that.
I was like, should I know about this product? But I just think it's fantastic. And I think no super original thought here, but like, I think the way we all do work is going to evolve dramatically. And we're just going to be able to do more. We can be video producers and producers.
I sent you an email from a friend of mine who's in the finance space. He's a content creator and he does charts and he does predictions about where the market's going based on a quant model that he has or whatever. And he's using Synthesio. This is obviously a portfolio company of yours as an avatar to articulate content that's just giving him a lot of leverage and the like. So I think all of us, if no matter what business you're in, to your point, not an original thought, but we're all seeing our workflows change dramatically. All right, let's get back to the enterprise, because when you think about it, and this is one thing, again, this was Perplexity, a company that a lot of people, it's on the tip of many people's, has $10 million in revenue, okay? So at this point, it's not particularly important. When you think about revenue opportunities, these large enterprise customers, talk to us a little bit about how you work with large enterprise. You must have some big partners, but you must also obviously have dozens, if not hundreds of customers. Florian, help us think about who you partner with and who your customers are.
We have hundreds of enterprise customers throughout the world, including 200 of the Fortune 2000 companies, so fairly large organizations. And so the way we like to think about our business is to partner with them in order to transform the way they think about data and their journey to AI. A lot around that is about enabling a self-service approach to analytics and ML and AI. And it's really about enabling people in the business to get access to their data, to build models on their own and so forth. Because I deeply believe that the actual revolution of AI is about empowering people having the domain expertise to become data experts. You could have the other perspective, the perspective that you could teach someone new in the company with a degree in data science to know everything about your company and get the job done, but never seen that work at scale. And the opposite, you've got in many organizations people that are really passionate about their domain, really passionate about the product. They have lots of ideas. But these days, in order to apply those ideas, you need data, you need AI, you need to use it in order to scale it. And with tools like ourselves, we found a way to actually give access to the data, access to AI techniques, so that people coming from a domain like product managers, like supply chain managers, like aerospace engineers, which are, well, technically rocket scientists, but they are not data people for that matter, like those people can actually leverage data more and transform the way business are done. And so that's how we work with large organizations. And when you start as a founder, you're never sure of what will work, what will won't work. And like today we are in a situation where we've got the largest pharmaceutical companies of the world, the largest retailers, the largest banks and so forth. So we reached some milestone there in terms of relevance. But indeed, I think that the best mistake or the worst mistake actually you can make as a founder is to be complacent. Like, we are still small, even at our size compared to what we could be given the opportunity of AI.
So talk about some of those verticals. You just mentioned healthcare and financial services. Are these two of the biggest verticals that you guys are focused on right now?
Yeah, there are some of the verticals, but our product is actually fairly generic and applicable to multiple industries. So we also have large insurance companies, large retailers, large manufacturers in automobile or aerospace as customers. Because that's the fun part. We are talking about AI and generative AI, but the actual revolution of the last 10 years is that data is everywhere. You've got sensors everywhere, which is to some extent why we can talk about AI now, is because for the last 10 years, there was digitalization and this revolution of data that is like the foundation to actually build those AI capabilities.
Obviously, your focus as a founder is just mission-driven, and you keep pushing and pushing. And a lot of the noise in and around the space, whether it's like some new startup that's funded by X and such, or this publicly traded company just touched $2 trillion in market cap because of their focus on this. Those are things that catch headlines. Those are things that I talk about all the day. Matt, you have one eye on them because it's like speaking to the sentiment in and around the space a little bit, but it's not really driving a lot of the decisions that you're making on a day-to-day basis. But I know you also read a lot of smart folks, as I do too. And here was something this morning from The Information, and the title was Amazon, Google quietly tamped down generative AI expectations. In the past year, major technology firms have championed Gen AI as the next big thing, boosting the stock market to new highs. But behind the scenes, representatives of major cloud providers and other firms that sell the technology are tamping down expectations with their salespeople and the like. So that's interesting. That's one publication. That's one story. That might not be a trend. It's probably where I think it's going, at least starting with the public markets, because we've just totally overshot in terms of market capitalization. When you think about a company like NVIDIA that has been at the forefront of every major technology shift over the last 5 or 6 years because of their GPUs, whether it was crypto mining, whether it was gaming, whether it was data center. So here we are in generative AI, and I get it. But this one, this time, in 2 months, it's gained $1 trillion in market cap. It's doubled. In my 25-year career in finance, I've never seen such a thing. I guess so when I see a story like this makes sense to me. So thoughts on that, Matt, about just sentiment, just like a little bit of a vibe check here.
It's always the unpopular thing to say because, you know, we're in this moment where there's like a belief system that puts itself in place where you have to be more enthusiastic than the next person. And the minute you say something that is not 100% enthusiastic, then you're labeled as a non-believer kind of thing. But look, I've been at First Mark for 10 years. This is my third AI hype cycle. There was one in 2013-14 when deep learning came onto the scene. There was another one around 17-18 with like chatbots and all the things and TensorFlow. And this is the third one. So like the third one is very public because of ChatGPT. Suddenly people realize the power of the thing. And by all means, AI keeps getting more impressive. But I think it's always the same thing. You know, what goes up must come down at some point. The stock price of NVIDIA is unnatural. So I'm actually very bullish on NVIDIA medium term. Long term, I think in the short term, I think it's going to be tricky. I think no company can really match these expectations. And look, the market is self-correcting. There are competitors emerging. There are people raising. Of course, it takes a long time to build an AI chip company, but that is happening. Then NVIDIA and TSMC are working on addressing that GPU shortage. So the market at some point is going to just realize that there is not that much demand of GPU right now. Long term, for sure. I think
double, triple ordering, and it could be China, it could have been a whole host of things need for that product right now.
And it's almost like unfair to NVIDIA. Like they've been at it since the mid-90s. So like everybody's getting excited about them, but those guys have been doing like incredible work for a very long time. And they've been playing the long game and having the longest view in the room about why the world needs GPUs. And then like suddenly, like overnight, like people just realize it's so important. So the stock price shuts up. It's almost unfair to them because it's going to go down like almost inevitably.
Florian, maybe the last one for you here is like, again, we spent some time talking about your background as a data scientist and an engineer and a builder, and you've been at Dataiku for more than 10 years now. You built other companies prior. What does it feel like? Obviously, you've had hundreds of millions of dollars invested in your company. You've done deals with some of the biggest enterprise companies on the planet. You continue to build, but now to see a sort of, I'll call it an interest bubble. We don't have to put our finger on just a valuation bubble, private or public, is who knows? That could continue to go for a long time. But what does it feel like to have one of these hype cycles come your way? You know what I mean? As far as things that you have believed about the technology industry, about every industry, how what you're building will actually find its way into a lot of other different industries. I'm just curious, how does that feel as a CEO, as a co-founder of a company who's basically established yourself as a player in the industry, and now everyone else is focused on what you've been doing for a long time?
Yeah, I think the trick is to keep thinking ahead, to force oneself to keep thinking about what will be the market like 5 years from now. not the market today, and to keep pushing for that reality forward instead of either the constraints or the opportunity of the moment. And I think that's a challenge for like many companies, many organizations, and but probably most CEOs, which is like, oh, you actually keep building a vision for 5 years ahead. And when I say vision, I don't mean vision in the pure mission vision sense, which is sometimes a bit abstract. It's like really thinking about what are the underlying economic drivers of the market, what types of products people will actually pay for, or do you actually maximize value capture in the future? What are the partners to get? What are the partners to drop? This kind of thinking. And I think the challenge is that indeed, when you've got a bubble like this intensity of AI, you might just get sucked into the moment. You could be like, oh my God, everyone is talking about AI. So am I thinking about AI? And indeed, you've got some external reality about AI, which are, for instance, right now, very much consumer focused. It's not about chatbot. It's about whether the new Twitch would be an AI Twitch, where instead of our kids looking at video games, they will look at AI players or AI agents or AI interviewers talking to one another all the time. Maybe that's a new reality we'll be sucked in. And so it's like all about, oh, instead of thinking about this, which is like more the moment and this intensity or this dream that people have today, where you actually think about the vision of your market, in our case, enterprise AI 5 years from now, and the kind of things we need to build today to make it happen. And that's the trick. That's the challenge.
Yeah.
Not to play Florian's hype man, but specifically that in addition to other things. And I was actually never quite sure what the secret was, but when you're a startup CEO, you got a million things to do, a million places to be, and Florian is uniquely good at being that chess player that thinks about three moves from now. And that was true as a seed stage company, that was true as a Series A, B, C company. And now that we are a pre-IPO company, that's still very much that. So it's been pretty impressive. What is the secret? Is like good people around you? Like, how do you do it?
I use an AI.
Well, hopefully we don't use too many AIs for too many things, because I left a bunch of Perplexity questions on the cutting room floor here, people. And it would have been a good conversation. But listen, guys, I really appreciate the conversation between the two of you. It's always really fun to hear this sort of relationship and how it's evolved and how you're adapting to the current environment. Matt and Florian, I really appreciate you joining us on OK Computer, the Funder and Founder series. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
If you like what you heard, make sure to hit follow and leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. We also want to hear from you. Email us at contact@riskreversal.com.